the week of December 1st, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 470, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, in the midst of a snowstorm, I'm Michael Giltz. I hope I survive.
You're in the midst of a state of emergency. Literally, you are in a state in New York City that the governor just declared a state of emergency.
Oh my God! It's exciting. It's, you know, yes, that's true. I had to slip back here over Thanksgiving holidays. I was supposed to go back to my brother's on Sunday, drop off my rental car and spend the night with him, hang out, have some food, you know, and then head back to New York City on Monday. But nope, I needed to change my airport where I was dropping off my thing, go to a different place 2 hours away, grab a bus, get into the city before everything shut down. That's what I did. So I didn't sleep at all two nights ago. Boy, was I tired Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Well, you know, you're not supposed to drive the bus yourself. You're supposed to let, you know.
I wanted to help.
Okay.
So I had a good Thanksgiving. Check. I went down to Nashville, had a Friendsgiving, as I've done for decades, friends from college, the Spencer Smiths, our other friend, John, came from Atlanta. We all had a grand old time in Nashville, Tennessee with the kids and friends from college and the son bringing a friend from school who couldn't get home to his family for the holidays. So, you know, we gave him a shelter in the storm. It was classic Thanksgiving. We had turkey that was smoked. We had corn, not corn, but corn, which is like a tofurkey. It's a vegan turkey substitute because our chef does not eat meat. And it was a great time.
Sounds like you had a very eventful week.
I did. And we saw three movies. I did. I saw Ford versus Ferrari. All of us saw Jojo Rabbit, and all of us saw Knives Out.
Wow. Okay. So you are responsible for the box office.
That's
this
right.
Week, then. Yeah.
So how was your Thanksgiving?
It was good. Spent a lot of it in Northern California where it was raining, and the storm that you're now getting hit with, we got hit with literally 1 week ago today. And it was, you know, knocking out power and there was no internet. And, you know, so actually that was a decent thing. You know, it was a week without hearing about politics.
You could have caught up on your emails.
Yeah. Well, oh, geez.
Did you cook?
I did not cook. I went to Napa Valley where family cooked.
All right. Well, okay. Is there some special Thanksgiving food you demand every year? Like you got to have that pumpkin pie. We had five different types of pies. Seven people, five pies.
A pie for everyone.
Practically.
Yeah. No, and there's nothing, nothing specific that I must have on Thanksgiving.
Well, the one thing we didn't get over Thanksgiving was an award. The National Arts and Entertainment Journalism Awards were announced. Nothing for us again.
You know, we don't submit ourselves. We really should submit ourselves.
Well, that would be step one, I guess. That explains that.
Yes, exactly.
Variety won 16 awards, including a top prize for best print publication. And the Hollywood Reporter won 10, including a very deserved one for best columnist for Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Very happy to see him get that. I hope someday he gets the Pulitzer. I think his work is really terrific there at the Hollywood Reporter. So congratulations to him for that.
Wow. Well, next year, definitely submitting.
Absolutely. There's probably a fee.
Yes, there is.
Well, next year we'll be talking about our wins at the National Arts and Entertainment Journalism Awards. But we got a show right now, Sperling. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, you might be able to tell I'm a little like, you know, languid, I think. Yeah, we're all still in a turkey coma. So for those of you who don't celebrate Thanksgiving, that's kind of what Thanksgiving does to you. Eat. The media, by the way, has been pretty sleepy too, with entertainment news on the back burner. Apparently, even Hollywood takes a break to spend time with their families once in a while. So the big story, yeah, exactly. The big story amounts to 2 weeks of box office with records falling left and right. And yes, by the way, 2019 looks like it will become the second highest grossing year of all time in North America.
Woohoo!
Yeah, in other words, it's a disaster, actually. The Grammy nominations came out, but we don't have much to say about it. Just a shout out to our favorite country album and a debate over whether the Grammys are finally getting it right or getting it wrong in a different way. On Inside Baseball, oh boy, you know how much I like this, Michael. Okay, I'm going to say
it. Oh my God.
I'm going to say the words.
Say it.
Paramount decree. In fact, the Trump administration, more specifically the Justice Department, but technically people that the Trump administration put into the Justice Department, they announced they will no longer support.
What was that weird distinction? What?
Well,
the Trump administration.
Well, but it's not.
It is. It's the Trump administration. They're in charge. It's not a separate independent organization. It's them. They're people in the Justice Department that they put there. It's like the people they put in charge of education hate education. The Justice Department really isn't a fan of justice.
Well, that's another story entirely. Yeah. But you know, the Justice Department and thus the people that Trump put into Department. It is the Justice Department.
Yes, and the people. But you make it sound like it's some weird new distinction you must make. The Trump administration said to hell with the Paramount Decree.
There's a huge distinction there, but we'll talk about it later when we talk about the Paramount Decree, which is, in case you haven't been listening to this show for umpteen years, a legendary decades-old ruling from the 1940s that has maintained a wall between film producers and, I guess, exhibitors. It's studios, really, and distributors and exhibitors. But no longer. What does that mean for Hollywood? Or have things changed so much it doesn't really matter anymore?
And not a lot of people know you get a quarter every time you say Paramount Decree.
That is correct. And that does come from the Justice Department, by the way.
Okay.
Yeah. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in. And this is a very big distinction. Michael is going to fill us in on last week's box office, not last weekend's box office.
Yeah, if there was ever a good week to do this, it is like a week like Thanksgiving, where you've got Thanksgiving on Thursday. And so you've got a lot of movies opening up on Wednesday, which means Tuesday night. You have movies that opened up the weekend earlier. And Frozen 2 in particular was making money hand over fist Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. So when you look at some charts, you're looking at Friday, Saturday, Sunday, when movies made tons of money on Wednesday and Thursday. It just proves the ludicrousness of how box office is looked at. You really should look at the entire week. Well, we've got 2 weeks for you. We have a chart for the week of November 24th. And that week, Frozen 2 opened up. It was huge. It opened up to $350 million worldwide. And Ford versus Ferrari was big number two with $51 million that week, showing it was really going to have good legs. So now we're going to look. You can look at our show notes to look at all of the movies on that week. Or you can go to our show notes and see the week of December 1st. That's the week of Thanksgiving, where we're looking at the worldwide box office for the previous 7 days. And the number one movie around the world, again, is Frozen 2. It made another $388 million. It's at just a little bit under $750 million worldwide after just about 10 days at the box office. This is a big hit.
Yeah, I would say so. Despite the kind of middling reviews that it got, everybody knew
the first one wasn't that well reviewed either.
Well, it's
not a good movie. It's just a big box office hit. Welcome to Hollywood.
Have you seen the movie? I have not seen the movie.
I have not seen it yet. I left my costume at home, so I really didn't want to go. It was cute. I went to see, like I said, a lot of movies. And at one time, I was in the men's room, and I heard some clicking of heels, and I thought, some guy, a transvestite perhaps, is using the bathroom of his choice. But I came out and it was a guy with his little daughter who he had brought into the bathroom with him because they were alone. So she was in the full Frozen outfit with it was just adorable. And they went down there. I even took a picture of them, to show it to my wife. I said,
Hopefully they were out of the bathroom when you did that. Otherwise you could get it.
That would be creepy. No, I waited till they were walking down the hallway to their theater. So okay. Frozen 2 was a big, big hit. $750 million worldwide. This is, it's well on pace to pass $1 billion. It's clearly going to do that. Looks like it's going to easily match the first ones of $1.3 billion. We'll have to see if the legs fall out from under because so many people saw it so many times so quickly. But this is unquestionably a huge hit. And I'm wondering if it's going to help the box office of the Broadway show. I think it will.
It probably will. I bet it will.
And then the big news after that in North America and kind of around the world were the legs and the impact of original movies. Movies that weren't part of a franchise. Movies, you had Knives Out and Ford versus Ferrari and the Mr. Rogers movie, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. You had other movies like Queen and Slim at the North American box office. All of these movies had a really big impact. Most Thanksgivings in North America and, of course, nowadays around the world, there are two big tentpole movies that get released, usually a Disney film and something a little more edgy, like Hunger Games or something, or a James Bond movie. This year, that didn't happen. It was just Frozen 2. So this Thanksgiving, despite that movie's massive numbers, is down ever so slightly from last year's Thanksgiving weekend. But that's okay because you had all these other movies that picked up the slack and made it a close call. So, looking at the box office overall, movies made for adults, movies that are going to have great legs, like Ford versus Ferrari, movies that are original, show they can really succeed at the box office. That brings us to our number two movie around the world. It's Knives Out, the Rian Johnson spoof celebration of Agatha Christie style all-star whodunit. That made $70 million worldwide, a great start for a movie that cost about $40 million to make.
You know, I think that this is kind of going to mark a trend, I think. So I'm putting my stake in the ground. I'm going out on a limb to say, I think that we're going to start seeing a turn more towards original films. We'll still get the blockbusters that are like the umpteenth version of, I don't know, insert name of Marvel film here. But I do think that more and more we're going to get original films as theatrical releases start to try and compete with Netflix movies.
I think you're right in terms of just be a little uptick in original films because there are only so many franchises out there. We're going to see as many of those as always, but they're going to realize they need original content. Netflix is eating their lunch, and if they don't want everyone to just sit at home and stream movies at Netflix, they better start creating some content made for people who are not so wildly excited or want to see something along with all those big franchises. So Knives Out was a big hit. Ford versus Ferrari, that had a second weekend of $40 million. I shouldn't say weekend. I should second week, where it made $40 million worldwide. Great holds in North America. It's at $143 million worldwide and counting. A bit of an expensive film. It cost about $100 million to make, but it's in 49, 50 territory, so it's got some expansion to go, and it's really going to play and play and play. I thought it was fun. At number four around the world is Mr. Rogers' movie, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. That made $21 million, and it's at $34 million and counting. Another flick that had a great hold.
And let me tell you, the number of people over Thanksgiving, over the age of 50, that went to see this movie and came back raving about it, this movie, I think, is going to have legs. I think it's going to actually do just as much money next week as it did this week.
Are you talking about family and friends, or were you strolling down Twitter lane, or what do you mean?
Well, both, actually. Family and friends first, then, kind of just strolling down Twitter lane, as you say, I would run across people who were raving about it. And of course, when I would kind of every once in a while peek into who these people were, they were always people, you know,
of a certain age.
Yeah, they were not millennials. Let's put it that way.
All right. Well, at number five around the world is a Chinese comedy. It's called Two Tigers. From what I can gather from the trailer, it looks like it's some sort of a comedy where they fake a kidnapping of a business exec in order to get the cash or something, but it made $19 million on its opening week in China. And number six around the world is Roland Emmerich's World War II epic Midway. That made $18 million this week. It's at $117 million worldwide. It's playing in 42 territories, so it too has some room to grow. We'll have to see where that ends up. I don't know about Midway, but I have to tell you, having seen the trailer three or four times and a featurette before the movie, the movie proper began, the film 1917 got great buzz coming out of the Thanksgiving weekend. I mean, everybody who saw it was like, oh, I want to see that. Oh, that looks good. Oh, that looks really interesting. Moms, you know, it has emotional involvement. It has the one long tracking shot. It's war. I think that movie is going to play and play come Christmas holidays because it sounds like they delivered.
Yeah, and I think it's also playing off the fact that it looks a lot like a Christopher Nolan movie. I mean, the number of people who have asked me, is that a Christopher Nolan movie? And
why would
no,
it look
not.
Like a Christopher Nolan movie?
I think only because Dunkirk was his last
well,
movie.
Well, those people you speak to are not very bright.
Well, I don't know.
At number seven around the world is Last Christmas, the Emma Thompson scripted or co-scripted comedy. It made $16 million this week. It's at $67 million worldwide. Mixed to dreadful reviews for the movie, but it's proving to be durable. This is going to play through Christmas, and it's going to be profitable because it only cost about $25 million to make. I don't care if it's not good. I want Emma Thompson to have a win every time out because someday I will marry that woman.
Are you participating in Whamageddon, I think it's called?
What is Whamageddon, and when does it happen, and I'll be there?
You have to try and mark how long you go into the month of December without hearing Last Christmas, the Wham.
And I assume you mean without hearing it specifically on demand by my own choice, because I did play the soundtrack from the movie and heard Last Christmas already, but that doesn't count because I chose to do it. I wasn't paying attention. I probably heard it in the diner last night because they have switched to 24 hours a day Christmas music ever since Thanksgiving happened.
Yeah,
actually, before Thanksgiving, they were on the holiday schedule of this one radio station. holiday music 24 hours a day. And I have to say, I love Wake Me Up Before You Go Go. That Wham and George Michael won me forever with that song. Great, great single. I always love the couplet where he said, "You make the you take the gray skies out of my way. You make the sunshine brighter than Doris Day." I thought, hey, you know, any young British guy in a pop song quoting Doris Day or, you know, alluding to her, that's pretty cool. That was always my favorite line in the song. But now I think it's become boom, 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 boom. I just, that's so pop. Anyway, at number eight around the world is Queen and Slim. Or I should say Bonnie and Clyde, because it's about two rebellious people out on the lam. Bonnie and Clyde, of course, is about criminals. Queen and Slim is about two people caught up in bad circumstances thanks to an overly aggressive cop. But it is meant to be a modern-day fable about outlaws, I'll put that in quote, where the people of color are heroes. It made $15 million. And here in North America, just like Knives Out and to a degree Ford versus Ferrari and A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, these movies all overperformed from what their estimates were. You know, tracking is sort of rough and difficult to do. The best thing that happens is when people see a movie, like it, and word of mouth is good, and so your tracking is off because a lot more people show up because they heard it's good. And that seems to be what's happening with all of those movies. People are satisfied all the way across the board with these films. At number nine around the world is 21 Bridges, the Chadwick Boseman thriller. It made $14 million this week, and it's at $26 million and counting. At number 10 is Joker, that pulled in another $13 million. It's, of course, well over the $1 billion mark. Charlie's Angels made some money. That made $8 million. That's at $51 million worldwide and counting. However, that's one of a number of movies that was not on the ComScore list. I'm not sure what happened. ComScore was very low. It just had like 11 films on its chart. It stopped at about the $5 million mark. And as I do when movie just drops off the chart, I checked to see what its worldwide total is to see, you know, maybe numbers were out there and for some reason it slipped off the chart. And well, looking at last week and comparing it to this week, Charlie's Angels made about $8 million. So it should have been on the list. I'm not quite sure why it wasn't, but the same is true for a number of other films like Playing with Fire, the John Cena comedy that made $6 million. Dr. Sleep, the Shining sequel, that made $5 million. The Helen Mirren, Ian McKellen movie, The Good Liar, that made $5 million. So all those movies should have been on the list. I didn't see them there, but checking their worldwide totals, it looks like they made that amount of money and they deserve to be on there. So we've got them on there with an asterisk, but there they are. They are movies. They're playing around the world. They're still pulling in coin. As far as we can tell, they deserve to be on our chart. Also, they're on that list.
I liked what Elizabeth Banks had to say about Charlie's Angels. Oh. When, you know, she directed the film and the Monday
not a big success.
The Monday after it opened, she said, "Well, look, if you're going to direct a huge box office flop, at least have your name on it four times. Because if you see the poster, it's like she's writing it, she's directing it, she's producing it, you know."
So, she's got a role.
Yeah, and I actually noticed that on the poster. I was like, they couldn't have just said written and directed by it. Like, there must be and of course, the reason that you can't say written and directed by it's written based on other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. She also has a lot of other projects in the works, TV and film, and she'll be just fine. Also in the mix, there is Somewhere Winter, a Chinese drama. It made $6 million last week. It's at $31 million and counting. And going down, another Chinese drama, Miss Forever. It's a romance. It made about $5 million on its opening week. Looking at the trailer, which did not have English subtitles, it looks like it's about two beautiful young people in love. He's a dreamy young guy he must be a musician because he's carrying an acoustic guitar around with him everywhere, but he looks dreamy whether he's wearing glasses or not wearing glasses. He loves her. He's afraid to tell her he loves her, even though he's gorgeous and she's gorgeous. And so she slips away and he pines after her forever. That's what I guess from the trailer. And finally, Better Days, another Chinese drama. That's the movie that was banned and then unbanned. Big, big box office hit. That's at $226 million worldwide. So you look at the chart and you see a lot of original movies. You see franchises delivering. You see original movies delivering. It was a very good week at the box office.
In fact, Frozen 2 helped Disney reach $3.2 billion in the domestic box office.
In North American box office alone. It's getting to the point where their worldwide total is practically big enough for a good solid year of the box office. If you just counted their money alone, you'd be like, oh, $8 billion, not so bad.
Right, exactly.
Where their North American box office surged past the $10 billion mark, despite Thanksgiving being slightly down from last year's record take. So again, it's probably the second highest grossing Thanksgiving of all time. It just didn't set a new record. And overall, as we said, annual box office totals are the second highest of all time. We were down quite a bit from last year. Now we're down just a smidge, just down 5% from last year's record high. That means 2019 is on pace to be the second biggest year of all time. If box office catches fire even bigger, like Star Wars, The Last Jedi, et cetera, or whatever it's called, this could be even a record year. But no matter what, it's looking to be a great year at the box office, even if it's quote unquote down from last year.
Well, what everybody is very concerned about, all the movie theater operators that I speak with, is next year. That's because, you know, there is no Avengers movie. All of the
There's five Marvel movies.
Right.
Relax.
And so I always say, look, you know, at some point there's going to be a movie that breaks out more than likely.
Well, there always is every year. That goes without
Black
saying.
Black Panther.
But that happens. Well, that was hardly a couldn't see it come and breakout. I mean, it made more money than one would have imagined. But,
exactly.
You know, it was a big property that people hugely anticipated. And again, Joker, will there be a sequel to that? While we were away, they said, yes, there will be a sequel. No, there will not be a sequel. Maybe there will be a sequel. We got 14 different stories. Todd Haynes marched into the studio the weekend after it opened up and said, here's my pitch for the sequel. And I want to do origin stories for all these other DC characters. And they said, yes. And then everybody said, it's not so true. So it made $1 billion. So somehow they may end up with a sequel, though. Joaquin Phoenix is not signed on yet. He did not commit to a sequel. Very much did not do that. But the only thing I thought would be a nice counterpoint to it would be if he did an origin story for Lex Luthor. It would be the flip side of Joker. Joker's about a guy who is marginalized and ignored and has mental health issues. Lex Luthor would be at a 1% villain. It would be the opposite, polar opposite. That could be fun.
How come nobody ever does a movie about Alfred?
They are. It's got a TV series. Are you kidding me?
Oh, geez. Who knew?
Yeah, no, it's got a pretty... Well, we do know that the WGA battle with agents is ongoing and not stopping anytime soon, don't we?
Yeah, it looks like Rothman Brecker, that agency, they've signed the code of conduct that the WGA has been requesting everybody, all the agencies sign. And a part of that is, no packaging fees.
That's right. And they got the right to own 5% of a production company.
Nice.
Right. They also said, hey, look, we want to give our writers the ability to block the sharing of contract info. At least coming from us, the WGA can insist their writers provide it to them, even though they haven't been enforcing that. But they want their writers to be able to say, I don't want that. So they're giving writers, I think, the ability to opt into that. And I think this is just a reflection of reality. It's not a real big change in the WGA position. But they've said, look, you can continue to package if we don't sign a deal with two of the four majors. So they're just facing reality and saying, well, we know you can keep packaging right now. And, you know, the final deal has not been signed. If we get two of the four majors to sign on, then you have to stop all packaging. But until that happens, we're not going to tie your hands behind your back. So I feel like that's a reasonable stance to take. There's one thing going on here, however. Some say there are only about 5 years left before packaging is extinct anyway, thanks to streaming and how that is upending all the contracts.
Because ultimately packaging, what you're really trying to do with packaging is to get to the residuals.
But aren't there, that's what they said, but my thought is, aren't there still major networks and hundreds of cable channels that still need content? Syndication isn't disappearing yet.
No, it's not disappearing
yet. Not to mention selling a show all over the world in which you want a piece of that.
Or selling it to Netflix, or selling it to Amazon Prime, or licensing HBO Max.
Renting.
Well, yeah.
Right. Well, that's important because you keep the rights to it and you can sell it again and again. So the idea that packaging will die with back ends, I don't think so. And if you've got a contract and you're saying, all right, streaming, you're signing with Netflix, they're saying there's no back end, so give us this fee and then it goes away forever. I would want a codicil in my contract saying, by the way, if you ultimately decide to sell Stranger Things into syndication, I want a piece of that. Or if you decide to rent...
I'm sure that's there.
Yeah,
I am sure it's there.
It better be. Well, people...
I'm sure
people,
it's there to a point where, like, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't there, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was there.
Well, if I'm your lawyer, and I've played one on TV, it will be there.
It's the kind of thing where, you know, okay, throw the boilerplate in even though it will never apply.
Yeah, well, this is new boilerplate, though.
Right. And, oh, by the way, take the boilerplate out because it's never going to apply. it wouldn't shock me either way. But that said, you know, it's not going to amount to very much.
So my friend wanted to watch Fleabag, but he hadn't seen it because he doesn't subscribe to, I think it's Amazon Prime.
Correct.
Right. He doesn't have Amazon Prime. And he said, well, I'll just wait till it comes to, you know, to Hulu or Netflix or something. And I said, well, that's not going to happen. He's like, what are you talking
about? Actually, with that one, it might, because that is a licensed show. I don't think that's an Amazon original. I could be wrong about that, by the way.
Hmm.
Wasn't it on in the UK first?
I think they helped fund it, but I could be wrong.
Oh, okay. So maybe that's true.
But my feeling was that with a show that small, that's so much of a signature of yours, and it's only 12 episodes, the chances of seeing a value and selling it out to me is far less. You know, like, I've got a signature show. Why would you want to shop it around? You're not going to get that much money for 12 episodes. And I would rather have it be a signature show that you come to my streamer for that purpose. However, I do feel like Netflix and others, like we've said, are missing the boat on some things, like One Day at a Time, where you might want to syndicate it. And you're missing a game here to make more money and extend the life of all the properties that you have. I think there will be a point in 5 or 10 years when you've made so much content that you say, you know what, if I made another 30 episodes, I could strip this puppy, because there are other ways to watch television other than streaming. But this is the new world we have. I just got a big, I think it was the Emmy magazine came in the mail, and it said streaming is the future on a big giant ad. And you thought, no, streaming is the present, right?
Yes, it is. And in fact, well, just to go back for just a second, Fleabag was a BBC production, and it was broadcast on BBC Three and then BBC Two and then ultimately BBC One. It was picked up by Amazon Prime Video. Now, what I will say to your point, this is the first Thanksgiving where I actually heard people, again, friends and family, where they were talking about streaming mm-hmm. in a way where they don't have cable and they don't have DirecTV anymore at all.
As we know, there's still like 85 million, 90 million households that do have cable. So we, you know, people talk, it's the end of the world. You know, it's like, it's a long, slow haul to untangle that.
Right.
Before, you know, they talk about it, they're aware of it as a possibility. But the fact is, you're going to pay $60 a month for Wi-Fi. You're probably going to be forced to have a phone line or something in there, or it'll be more expensive. And then you're going to want a skinny bundle. And then you're going to want some streaming channels. Well, guess what? HBO Max and Netflix and Disney Plus, you're up to $35. Guess what? You've got $95 and you have three channels, Wi-Fi and three channels. Enjoy. As you and I said, you think cable is a horrible proposition, and they did overcharge, but this isn't such a great deal either, is it?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately what's happening is that the content aggregators are actually beginning to have the upper hand mm-hmm. in these negotiations. So it used to be that CBS, NBC, IFC, I mean, CNBC, ESPN, they used to have the upper hand. And that's why you'd get into these carriage disputes, right? Where you would.
Yeah. We're just talking about now, streaming. Now it's very expensive to switch to streaming, and you get far fewer channels for a lot of money.
Right. And now, because of streaming, and that's where I was headed with this, because of streaming, it's the other way around now.
We're not arguing about carriers.
Amazon and Hulu. And now, of course, the MVPDs, the cable operators, are also it does matter, because they're actually getting the benefit of turning around and saying, you know what, ESPN, we don't have as many subscribers anymore. We don't want to pay as much.
That's an entirely different story. Yes, that's true. I'm talking about the consumers and the fact that suddenly today it's going to be really hard to keep up. You used to be, if you heard about a new show called Mad Men, you could say, well, let me go to AMC and check it out. Nowadays, you can hear about a new show and go, oh, it's on Disney Plus, I don't have that. Oh, it's on Hulu, I don't have that. There's a lot more of, oh, I don't have access to that. I don't have that. I can't check it out. And I think content providers are going to realize that this brave new world isn't so exciting when your show can't catch fire as easily, because people can't simply change the channel and check it out. That's right.
That is actually what I would agree with that. And that was actually the conversation around the Thanksgiving dinner table, was what service do you have? What shows are good on that service? Should I get Hulu? Should I get Apple Plus?
Did any of them feel like they didn't want or need Netflix, or did they feel that was sort of like one of the basic building blocks?
That was like the basic build. Everybody seemed to know Netflix. You have Netflix, yeah, right? Yeah. The question is, do you get Hulu on top of that? Yeah. That was really the question.
Well, that's, you know, it's a big deal for Netflix. They're in their first mover. They were the early adopter. And so everybody who got them feels like they're, you know, that's part of their system. They don't even question it. I think it's going to be a long time before others can chip away at them or make them hurt. Others may succeed. They may be even bigger, like Disney Plus, but that won't affect the fact that Netflix has a huge subscriber base and they're pulling in lots of money. And once they slow down on their spending, they'll be just fine.
Well, if Netflix subscribership does drop, that would be a big
deal. Oh, it would be.
And I wonder if some of the stories in our big deal or big whoop segment this week will be too. In fact, it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense.
Every week when we go to our show on Mondays, we have Big Deal or Big Whoop. And normally while we're doing the show or that morning, as we're getting ready for the show to record, I'm checking the email constantly. A new story. There's always 2, 3, or 4 Norse stories that jump into the Big Deal, Big Whoop at the last minute because news happens on Monday. Not this year. Everybody's still sleeping from their turkey. We haven't added one news story to Big Deal, Big Whoop all morning long. It's a shocker. But anyway, what is our first story?
Our first story is about the Grammy nominations because they happened while we were away. We tried to get them to hold off, but no, they did it anyway. And by the way, some people did get nominated.
Yay.
Yeah, some people did not, actually. We won't predict who's going to win Album of the Year, but one thing is clear. The Grammy nominating committees, they did their job this year for the first time in history. You don't see a lot of lazy nominations in the major categories. Okay, yes, under pop vocal album, you do see like two ridiculous albums. John Legend's Christmas album, okay? And Barbara Streisand's Walls, which even her fans had already forgotten about. I was like, wait, she had an album this year? But album of the year, the old fogies in it are just Bon Iver and Vampire Weekend. I don't think either one of them existed in 2010. So it's not the usual legacy artists well past their prime. The rest include Lana Del Rey, Billie Eilish, Ariana Grande, Her, Lil Nas X, and Lizzo. We're not saying those are the best albums of the year, but they're certainly current artists. On the other hand, ignoring big-selling acts like Ed Sheeran in favor of obscurities like Her and Bon Iver isn't any cooler than ignoring them for knee-jerk nominations for old fogies like the Rolling Stones or Steely Dan. So maybe the committees just stink, but in a whole new way. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's a big whoop. The Grammy nominations are never satisfying, and they never will be unless you get to do them all yourself.
You know, I kind of felt like Bon Iver was like that indie film that gets nominated for Best Picture that, you know, doesn't have a hope of winning.
Right. I thought, oh, well, that's not bad. And then when I saw some commentary and perspective, they sort of changed my mind when they were pointing out all these sort of like Her getting it 2 years in a row, tons of nominations. And they're thinking, really? Do you think Her is that big? And, you know, and they're just pointing out the prejudices or biases of certain committees and how they're getting it wrong, but in a different way where they weirdly focus on some smaller act. It's not that Bon Iver and Her aren't good necessarily, but are they the most representative best choices of the year? And they convinced me that while they aren't doing the old Steely Dan route, they are making some mistakes. However, I was excited for Tanya Tucker. Her album While I'm Living is one of my favorite of the year. I'd never thought about her twice. I mean, I beg your pardon, but the only song I knew by her was I Never Promised You a Rose Garden. And I never thought, you know, oh, Loretta Lynn, yes, I want to hear her albums. Other country artists who are important and major. Tanya Tucker never crossed my mind, but she had a new album out. She's an aging artist, you know, been around forever, a veteran. I thought, give it a listen. I knew nothing about it, and I played it. I'm like, this is really good. Like, what the heck? I mean, it's really good, like Loretta Lynn's Van Leer Rose with Jack White. That album was a career peak for her. She had many of them. For Tanya Tucker, as far as I know, it's her best album by far. And I was driving or listening to the music, and I just couldn't really check out what was going on. But when it was over and I had a chance, I said, what? Who wrote these? Did she write these? What's happened? Turns out it was A Labor of Love by Brandi Carlile. She had a great year last year or the year before at the Grammys. Terrific artist, a breakout album. And she worked with Tanya Tucker. She co-wrote or wrote almost all the songs on the album. She produced it with Shooter Jennings. It was just a terrific project. So, you know, she's doing a lot of producing stuff. So this is someone who's had a big moment and is really making the most of it in a lot of different interesting ways. So shout out to Brandi Carlile for doing a great job with Tanya Tucker. And I was thrilled to see it nominated for Best Country Album of the Year. It's not just a, oh, she's an old veteran and we love her. It's well-deserved.
Shooter Jennings.
What did I call him?
I'm confirming it's Shooter Jennings.
Unless I got the name wrong, I believe so.
Okay, well, no, I think it's kind of an
interesting
name.
It's country
name.
Music, dude.
Yeah, I just think, you know, you go into a store, what's your name? Shooter. It's like, whoa, hey.
It was, in fairness, he was born Waylon Albright Jennings, but he goes by Shooter. So he's got 7 albums on his own and a bunch of EPs. He's been in some movies. He's a very active, terrific talent.
Well, progress is progress, okay? In the 2018-2019 TV season, half of all TV episodes were directed by women and or people of color. Overall,
half.
Some 4,000...
Half. That's pretty great.
Half, Eddie. Half. Do you know what that's from?
No.
It's from Raw. Eddie Murphy's talks about getting divorced and how the wife always takes half, Eddie.
Never watched it. Never found him funny as a stand-up.
Well, overall, some 4,300 TV episodes were created for North America, and fully 31% were helmed by women. That's more than doubled in the past 5 years, and some 27% of all episodes were directed by people of color, up about 40%. That's major and consistent growth and involves real numbers, not some one-off quirk. The Directors Guild of America applauded the growth while cautioning that most first-time directors never film a second episode or movie, so much work remains. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a very big deal. It's a lot of episodes. It's a lot of people getting work. When you look at the top 100 grossing movies of the year and say, how many were directed by women and people of color? Well, you can jump by 100% because you went from 2 to 4. And then next year, you're back down to 1 movie being directed by a woman or, you know. So those numbers can jump up and down very easily because they're so small. And so those percentage increases are meaningless because, again, you're talking about 2 movies going to 3 movies. It increased by 50%. So in this case, you're talking about half of all episodes, some 2,150 episodes were directed by women or people of color. That is a titanic change. It's happened steadily and consistently over the last 5 years, and it's great to see because the more people that get opportunity, the more diverse talent you'll see and the better stories that will be told.
China is cracking down on kids' addiction to video games. The government announced kids would be banned from public video game parlors except on national holidays. It's the latest step to curb what Chinese leaders see as a decadent, dangerous practice. In the past, kids have been banned from internet cafes, given a monthly cap on video game spending, and many places have been banned from offering gambling machines like slots entirely. Of course, whether these new rules will be strictly followed is another matter, since all those other restrictions have been poorly enforced. We'll find out when this newest restriction begins in January, so big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm going to say it's a big whoop, and you know, for a country that follows its citizens every step of the way and takes points off your citizenship rating when you jaywalk, you know, you would think they'd be able to follow this and do what they want. So whether they just don't care enough to ban, why they're bothering to do it symbolically, to put teeth behind it, I don't know why they're doing this and not following through. Not that I'm calling for the repressive practices that China does, but if they really mean it and really crack down on it, that'll be something interesting to see.
You know, years ago, I want to say the movie was Web Junkie. I could be wrong about that. But it was specifically a movie about the kind of addictions that take place in China with...
Oh, they fall asleep, you know, 20, 36 hours in a row, da-da-da.
Yeah, and it was really just an amazing documentary because they'll send them off to, like, these clinics where they have to stay there nonstop for, you know, months on end to, like, kind of
detox.
Rid them of the habit. Yeah, exactly.
Well, I spent Thanksgiving watching college students stare at their phones, so I know what they're talking about.
Yeah, that's another problem. Now, theater owners have pretty much a hate-hate relationship with Netflix, so the streaming company has decided if you can't beat them, join them. Instead of convincing exhibitors to shrink their windows, Netflix has decided, you know, it's going to buy another movie theater. New York City's Paris Theater is the last remaining single-screen theater in the city, and it closed abruptly a few weeks ago. The plan was to turn the venerable space into, you know, a medical clinic, for Pete's sakes. Good grief. First, it got a reprieve when Netflix reopened it for screenings of its major Oscar contender, Marriage Story, by Noah Baumbach. Now they've taken it over for good, presumably as an exclusive venue for Netflix movies and the future home for Martin Scorsese's The Irishman as award season continues. So Netflix has The Egyptian in LA and The Paris in New York City. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I guess it's a big whoop, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's basically they're buying a screening room.
Yeah.
And it's a really nice screening room, but still.
It is. It is. It's a great space. For years, it seemed like the Merchant Ivory people had that a lock on the Paris. Every Merchant Ivory film opened there and ran for months and months and months. It has a balcony section. It's a wonderful place to see a movie. With the passing of the Ziegfeld, it's been so heartbreaking that, you know, the Paris was the last single screen venue available. It's not that I have anything against 20 screen venues. They're just great spaces to see a movie. If it was a 20 screen venue and one of them was like the Paris, I'd be like, great, awesome. But they don't have the romantic balconies, the beautiful spaces, the giant screens where you're seeing a movie with 1,000 people. And really, again, when I went to these movies over Thanksgiving, you feel so isolated when you're in those big, gigantic lounger chairs. You're just not hearing the noise and laughter of people around you as much. I saw Ford versus Ferrari and Jojo Rabbit in that type of theater. And then I saw Knives Out, thank goodness, in a slightly older theater. So it was still stadium seating and nice seats, but they were normal seats. They were not the Barca lounger. And you know what? That really helped for the movie because you could hear everybody around you talking and laughing. And it made a big difference.
Well, I'm going to put a pin in something that relates to this, and that is the Avalon on Catalina Island. We'll be talking about that during Inside Baseball.
And speaking of The Irishman, our in-house film critic Aaron Rich is watching that movie, and he says, oh, he really should have gone to the theater to see it because it's taking him days to watch it. He's just struggling. He finds it so slow and boring. As I've told people, if you want to see it, it's best to be trapped in a theater when you do it.
Wow. So have you seen it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I saw it. I saw it at a screening before it opened.
Okay.
Not good.
No,
not good at all. No.
Okay. Well, NBC hired two new judges for America's Got Talent last season. They especially hoped Gabrielle Union would boost their social media visibility. Well, she certainly did, actually. AGT's social media presence hit a new high, and half of the total traffic, the social media traffic, was linked to Union directly. Nonetheless, for the fourth year in a row, ratings gently declined. And for perhaps the first time, new judges were dumped after just one season, a single season, and they were out. Yes, of course, America's Got Talent rotates hosts a lot, but not that quickly. One problem? When a new judge brings a big social media presence to the table, she can use that when getting fired for no good reason.
Oopsie.
Yep. Union said she was painted as trouble for objecting to a racist joke by Jay Leno, racist content of one act, and was continually criticized for her hairstyles being quote-unquote too black. A Twitter storm ensued, and now SAG-AFTRA, the union, is investigating. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I think. Not because the issues don't matter, but because nothing is going to happen or change from it substantially. Nick Cannon was a host on the show. He quit amidst claims of racial insensitivity. They've probably got a pretty toxic atmosphere. It's a big, smooth-running machine. It makes a lot of money. And why they dumped Gabrielle Union and Julianne Hough after just one season, I have no idea. The show's on a sort of a slow, steady decline in the last 4 years, but nothing dramatically different happened. And Gabrielle Union really did dramatically boost their social media presence. So she did everything they asked her to. So it was a poor choice, but obviously nobody got along with anyone. But they didn't get along with her because she was saying, hey, how about less racism? So a hard argument to argue for. But they are trying to work with her and get a public statement together. I don't know what they could possibly say in a public statement that would make up for, you know, dumping her, but it's not going to be pretty.
Broadband needs to get broader. Okay, thanks to the growing popularity of music streaming services and a crush of video streamers ready to compete with Netflix and YouTube, streaming in the U.S. has hit a new high. According to one study, audio and video on-demand streams passed 1 trillion streams in a single year, a single calendar year, for the very first time. Since Disney Plus and Apple TV and other services just launched, or, you know, really haven't even started yet, HBO Max, for instance, you can be certain that that number of a trillion, it will easily be surpassed in 2020. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, just like we've been talking about earlier, streaming video sites are the biggest change in television since pay cable arrived in the 1970s. And this is just one more example of the ripple effects of that. Do we have the structure, the infrastructure to accommodate this?
Well, there's the rub. The answer I found out this weekend in Napa Valley, okay, Napa Valley, the reason you hear about it and know about it is because that's, you know, the ground zero for the American wine industry, at least in California.
And who better to speak about broadband service than people drinking a lot of wine?
Well, no, what I mean is it's technically considered basically a farming area, right? And let me tell you, they do not have.
Well, that's a different issue. The farming, the rural outreach. Yes, that's absolutely true. I'm just asking for the infrastructure we have in place. Are they going to be overwhelmed by all the streaming video demand? Or like we've been hearing for years that they have the access, they have the ability, but they're just trying to charge people more money anyway. That they have the ability to handle.
I think it's more the latter. I think for urban areas, mm-hmm. it's more the latter. I do think that, yes, I think as it grows and becomes more pretty much dominant, I think you'll see that.
It could create some serious traffic.
Yeah, but I think for the most part, it'll be fine.
Yeah. And what about 5G? My sense is that 5G is coming, but it's super expensive and need a lot more towers. So those rural areas are going to fall even further behind. And so 5G can move really fast, but getting good 5G coverage sounds like a really challenging issue, not technically, but just logistically in terms of setting up all those towers that you need so much closer together than you do for what we have right now.
Well, you just kind of hit the nail on the head. It's 5G, unlike what we have now, 4G LTE, is you need more towers because the signal does not go as far. So you need the
dramatically more towers.
Yeah, dramatically more towers. You have to be closer to those towers to actually get that kind of speed. But if they can actually build out the infrastructure, it would eventually dominate. It might even put cable to shame.
Hmm. Well, you know, that sounds like something we'll cover in Inside Baseball sometime down the road. But right now it is time for that section where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Why am I talking? Because this is about the Paramount Decree, and nobody should be answering questions about the Paramount Decree more than our own expert, Sperling Reich. My God, you've been mentioning the Paramount Decree every week, every episode since we began. In fact, we bury it subliminally in a backwards masking thing on every episode if it doesn't come up in the show, just so Sperling can say Paramount Decree every single episode.
I think you've now said it 3 or 4 times. Didn't I get paid? You said I got paid mm-hmm. for every time I mentioned. So you now owe me what? Like
75 cents.
75 cents. Okay,
right. It is a new around. Checking. The Paramount Decree has been around for 70 years. You're working on a story for Celluloid Junkie right now, aren't you? When are you going to post that?
This week, most likely.
All right. You make sure you include it in our Showbiz Sandbox feed and in our Twitter account so people can check it out when it's live. And maybe we'll be discussing it some more next week. But basically, it's been around for 70 years. And it's a ban on block booking that is still needed, according to the North American theater owners. Studios can demand their entire slates be carried and thus crowd out indie films and documentaries. Can exhibitors still demand a 90-day window? Does this affect that? Netflix and Amazon, they own their own chains without any threat of government interference. What is going on, Sperling?
Well, so, okay, just to backtrack 70 years, for those who don't know, it was a time when the government actually sued Paramount and several other studios. Paramount at the time just happened to be the biggest studio, so that's why it's called the Paramount Decree. It's a consent decree. So basically, at the time, the studios owned movie theaters, and they would force these movie theaters to play single movie they made.
Their own theaters. They didn't force them. They wanted to. You'd have theater chains that were basically Columbia theater chains and Paramount theater chains and MGM theater chains, and they showed all their own movies in their own theaters. And every week they had new content coming in and more content going out, and they owned it from soup to nuts.
And it helped create the studio system. That said, along comes this consent decree. And
why did they want to end that? Why did anybody get involved?
Well, because certain movie theaters couldn't get content. You know, if you were an independent and you weren't owned by a studio, you couldn't get the content because it was going directly to a specific movie theater that was called circuit dealing.
Mm-hmm. But I mean, if I'm CBS Television Network and somebody else is trying to form their own TV station, do they really come, hey, how come you won't let me have all your CBS shows? You know, why do people think that an independent theater chain had the right to have access to movies made by MGM?
Well, that gets very complicated.
Yeah, but I mean, you sell products in your own Apple store, and you don't necessarily make those products available anywhere else. I'm wondering why movies are a little different.
Well, you know, that's really what the whole case was about. It was about vertical integration. It was about monopolistic power.
And how that could hurt consumers, ultimately.
Exactly. And ultimately, that's really what it amounted to. How will this hurt consumers? And it was hurting consumers because some theater chains in certain regions couldn't get certain movies.
So you'd be in Oklahoma and you wouldn't get to see the movies.
Exactly.
And there was price fixing, right?
Correct. And that was the other thing. The studios would go in and say, well, okay, you can show the movie, but it has to be for $5, which means, you know, everybody else across town will go to my movie theater.
Or more likely 50 cents rather than 35
well,
cents.
Well, yeah, exactly.
And what's block booking?
Block booking is when you say, okay, you can show Star Wars, but if you're going to show Star Wars, you also have to take this other film that is hardly known called Stuber. Okay, so if you play Stuber, I'll make sure you get Star Wars.
Hilariously, when Star Wars was coming out, they forced people to bring Star Wars by saying, if you want this other movie that's turned out to be a big flop, you have to show Star Wars as well. They were doing that in the 70s. So all these things...
Well, actually, it was against the law in the 70s. Yeah. Fox got sued for that, and ever since then, it was one film, one theater at a time. You couldn't go in and say, okay, AMC, I want Star Wars across your circuit. That's called circuit dealing. Where you say, I'm only going to show it at AMC, and you can't do that. Block booking, you couldn't hold one film. You couldn't tie films together.
Right.
You couldn't do a whole slate. That had a whole thing to do with copyright, where, for instance, the copyright on Star Wars, incredibly valuable, right?
Sure.
I mean, the copyright on Stuber, maybe not as valuable. So you would be kind of lending value to Stuber from Star Wars. Mm-hmm. That's effectively what they stopped doing.
So for 70 years, the consent decree, the Paramount decree, helped prevent all these things. It made sure studios did not own theater chains so that there was more of a market. It helped prevent price fixing and block booking and circuit dealing and all these problems that could have been bad for people. And some studios were not part of the consent decree like Disney, but everybody basically followed the rules anyway. Even though they weren't technically under this ruling, they followed it anyway because they wanted to be good boys and girls and not have the government breathing down their neck.
For the most part, right. Every once in a while, you'd get like a lot of, kind of jostling where you'd kind of say, well, wait a second, why can't I get this movie? And it was, oh, well, you're in Palm Springs and we're showing that movie in LA, so there's a clearance there. And what that is, consent decree kind of did away with overbroad clearances. So if you're showing a movie at the Chinese Theater in Los Angeles, well, okay, you can't play it at the Arclight, which is down the street. That's a clearance. But what about 10 miles away? That's overbroad. So all of these indie theaters would say, wait a second,
I'm in a wholly different market, basically, and you're still screwing me over.
Or the big chains are forcing the studios to have an overbroad clearance, and there'd be all these lawsuits, most of which the indie exhibitors would have to eventually settle because they do not have
the money.
Yes, the legal fortitude and the legal resources to keep going.
Right, the major suing. Studios can just wear you out.
Right, and in fact, in 1962, Lowe's Inc. Was sued for this kind of block booking stuff. And so in other words, what you're saying, Michael, is true, right? It did kind of...
It helped keep a muzzle on people to a degree.
Right.
All right. So
now what I'll point out is, and people are saying, well, why all of a sudden is this an issue? The Justice Department is looking at all of these consent decrees, okay? Not only just... There's like 1,300 consent decrees that were done before 1970... After 1970, consent decrees had a limit, a time limit. So like, for instance, when Comcast bought NBC Universal, there was a consent decree that said, Comcast, you can't raise broadband prices for 7 years. But after that time, the consent decree went away. There was no time limit on the Paramount decree, much like these other 1,300 decrees. However, a lot of these consent decrees... They're like about buggy whips and companies that don't even exist anymore. So you can get rid of these legacy decrees. It doesn't matter because it doesn't apply anymore. This particular one definitely applies. And there were lots of comments to the Justice Department's announcing that they would be reviewing it. The public was allowed to comment. All the comments came from NATO, the Writers Guild, independent theater owners. So this was something that people took very seriously because it is, especially block booking, especially now that you have these giant corporations like NBC Universal, like Disney, that could come in and basically say, yeah, we're making fewer films and you're going to have to play them and you have to play all of them and you have to play them at the following terms. Remember the Avalon? I said I'm going to put a pin in that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to pull that pin out now. The Avalon on Catalina, big historic movie theater built in 1928 by Wrigley, the chewing gum guy. Well, that theater is closing down at the end of this year because, in part, because not enough people are going, in part because they have to show the same film on an island with 4,000 people on it. They have to show the same film for 2 weeks because that's what the studios want. Those are the terms, period. And they're saying, look, we can't show the same
film for 2 weeks. We exhaust our audience after 1 week.
Right. So can, and, but that's the terms. So the studios will definitely push on this. Now, you might wonder if you're in another country, well, what does this have to do with me? This is how, this is what forces studios to make different films and to, and exhibitors, it allows exhibitors to program more diverse content. So their studios are already making fewer films. They will make even fewer if this,
and
this comes
carry
to pass.
Them for longer on more screens. You know, you have 4,000 screens for their five movies. You have no room for any docs or for international films or anything.
Right. And so one of the pushbacks is, well, there's, you know, all these multiplexes and, you know, no problem. You can just, you know, there's no problem getting a movie booked these days. And then there's the concept of, well, you don't have to worry about diversity. Those people can just stream it. You know, the people that don't have movie theaters in their town. Well, sometimes the reason you don't have a movie theater in your town is because you do live in a rural area.
No, you don't have streaming very easily either.
Exactly. So there's a lot of things that could go wrong here. And what has to happen now is they have to go back to a judge because it is a consent decree. They have to go back before a judge, and the Justice Department and the studios have to say, yes, we would like all of get rid of them. And a judge then has to make the decision and say, yes, I hear what you're saying, and I've read all the comments, and I agree with you. Let's get rid of the consent decree. And I can tell you, a lot of people will be pushing back on this.
Right, but when you love competition and the free market, when you're a tiny little company like Apple in your garage, just being formed, but when you become a big, massive corporation, you hate competition. You want to be a monopoly. And that's what those big guys are pushing for, and that's what might just well happen here.
Well, you know what? You know who you haven't heard me talk about in all of this? Mm-hmm. Any of these big companies. You haven't heard me mention the fact that they haven't made a statement.
Because they love it. They'd love to see it.
Exactly. Absolutely. Exactly. That's what I mean, I remember a time when 20th Century Fox, they would literally, if you were a film buyer talking to 20th Century Fox about a movie and they had another movie coming out, they would hang up the phone after talking about the first movie and call you back. They wouldn't take any bookings via fax or email because that was, they just didn't do it. Because
they didn't want a record of what they were saying or doing.
Exactly. Hmm. Exactly.
Well, that's contradictory because the other fact of hanging up and calling back again seems to be an attempt to follow the letter of the law.
Correct.
Right. So that's one side. But the other side is that they didn't want anything in writing because they were sort of saying, this movie looks good too.
Well, no, the issue with in writing, because I asked about that, I thought the same thing. I thought, well, you're just proving that you guys are doing block booking. And the head of distribution at the time said, no, the problem that we have with bookings that come in via fax or bookings that come in via email is that the exhibitor will place information about two movies on the same email. We don't want that.
So this is something we're going to talk about for months to come. The Paramount decree, will it die forever or will it live on?
Well, given the current government, it'll probably die.
And that brings us to the obituary section, doesn't it?
Oh, I see what you were doing there.
I could talk about it for hours, but I feel like we should move on.
Okay, well, I added one to the end of
it. I know, I saw it.
Our obituary. Okay,
we've got a lot of people this week who died in the last 2 weeks, and they're all right. Sort of interesting people with fascinating little careers. Michael J. Pollard died at 80. He's an actor. He was an Oscar nominee for the film Bonnie and Clyde, which we've already mentioned this week, one of the great films of all time. He appeared on stage on Broadway with Warren Beatty in a play. That was a good idea because, of course, he then got into Bonnie and Clyde, and ultimately he was even in Dick Tracy, which Warren Beatty starred in and directed. He also starred in the original Broadway cast of Bye Bye Birdie. Walt Disney loved him, thought he would be one of his big juvenile leads, but Pollard ended up only making one movie for him. He had a string of film and TV roles. He was a journeyman actor, some problems with alcoholism that he overcame. But, I mean, he was in Melvin and Howard. He was in Roxanne. He has a cool link to the band Traffic. That's one of the big progressive rock bands of the 1970s. And he hung out with the guys, and they were about to make a film. They were toying with the idea, and he was scribbling out ideas. And for some reason, he wrote out the phrase, the low spark of high-heeled boys. Not only did that title be grabbed by the band, become one of their biggest songs of all time, it was also the name of one of their best-selling albums. So that's a funny little quirky thing. But here's the thing I love about Michael J. Pollard. Actor Michael Fox, you know, from Back to the Future and Family Ties, when he was becoming an actor, he had to register with SAG. But his name, Michael Fox, was already taken. So he had to do something new. And then suddenly he remembered one of his favorite character actors. And so he added a J as a tribute to Pollard. So,
that's interesting.
I did not know that.
You know, sadly, we also are talking about somebody who is very young, and it's a K-pop star, Gu Hara.
Yes. Oh, she died at 28. She is a Korean K-pop star, and as we've said before, the white hot spotlight of social media in Korea. I don't know if it's worse than other countries, but when your whole life depends on social media, you know, that becomes very intense and can become very negative. That's why when that idiot on YouTube who made that comment about the dead body in the forest that he stumbled across in Japan. Yeah, you know, I just get very worried when you sort of just pile on him and describe him as a, you know, an evil, hateful person. It's like, you know what? These are actual people, and you don't want to forgive when they make mistakes, but you also don't want to treat them like they don't have emotions. So Gu Hara was a big K-pop star. She was in the group Kara for about 7 years. She went solo. She did movies and TV roles. She was really big in Japan, seriously. And she was close friends with K-pop.
Big in Japan and Korea.
Yeah, well, certainly Korea. She was close friends with K-pop star Suli, who died by suicide in October. And Gu Hara attempted suicide in March when an ex-boyfriend was blackmailing her and threatened to release a sex video. And now apparently it's not confirmed yet, but she may have died by suicide as well. So I don't know if the social media spotlight is harsher in Korea, but it certainly gets a lot of attention around the world when something tragic like this happens. So you feel bad for her and hope people can learn some lessons and change something to make sure that people anywhere dealing with social media are not, don't feel so beleaguered and victimized and attacked when, you know, they do wear the wrong dress or cut a new haircut and it's not the nice one. It's just a sad, depressing problem.
You know, I don't know how, but, and you're going to wonder where I'm going with this, Michael.
I often do.
But we have talked about how both of us in our time in New York, going to screenings, we would always see Sylvia Miles. She would be at everything. We've talked about her on this show before. She was an actress that didn't really have many credits, but somehow was in the Academy. She was nominated for an Academy Award for Midnight Cowboy.
And she was at every party. She was a party goer, a party crasher, just a professional party goer.
And even in death, she is popping up in our stories here on Showbiz Sandbox because critic John Simon died at 94. And famously, she dumped a plate of food on him at the New York Film Festival in 1973.
Yeah, he said the story was retold so many times because so many people were delighted that she did it, that he said if you collected all that food together, you could solve hunger. He was known for being a bastard. You know,
pretty much.
He was a reviewer at New York Magazine for, I think he covered theater for them for decades. He also covered film and books and everything. He was erudite and knew, you know, was a sophisticated and worldly and nasty and mean. I worked with him briefly at New York Magazine. He was always polite to me, friendly, nice person, but really hateful in print. I mean, he was so famously hateful that he was even on the sitcom The Odd Couple. You know, he was a well-known figure, made some truly nasty, hateful comments about Barbara Streisand and others. But it wasn't just the most famous people. He would just say nasty, negative comments about people's appearances on stage when he didn't like them. He just felt like he only wanted to see beautiful people on stage. And I like pretty people. But when you're talented, to me, that overcomes, you know, everybody who's talented is beautiful. Nathan Lane is gorgeous when he's on stage. You know, he's the most fascinating person in the room. But John Simon was really kind of fascistic about the appearance of actors, especially women. And, you know, he had a career and hopefully we won't see his like again. I mean, online critics are just as nasty and mean as him, but he had more weight because there were so far fewer critics. It wasn't 10,000 people making their nasty comments. There were only like 20 or 30 major critics and he was one of them. And so it really had an impact when he would say these things. You know, but this is funny. When he had the stroke that killed him, he was at a dinner theater production in New Jersey. That'll kill him.
Oh, really?
That will kill anyone. And Owen.
Now, do you think he kind of lightened up in his later years? Because you saw him at a screening of Tony Erdman, and he said he liked it.
No, he didn't. No, No. Oh, okay. One of the last times I saw him was at a screening of Tony Erdmann. It was just him and I in a screening room, the Sony screening room down off Union Square. The movie ended. I liked it more than him, not as much as you. But the movie ended, and he went, well, that was lovely. Very sarcastically. And I went, that's exactly like my... He goes, no father's like that. I go, that actually reminded me of my dad a lot. And we started chatting. But he was very old, very feeble at the time. And he kind of vaguely remembered me from New York Magazine. He knew he sort of should maybe know me, but wasn't quite clear why or how. But he was a little lonely towards the end. I mean, he had a wife and whatever, but he was a little lonely. And he's like, which way are you going? And I'm like, oh, I'm sorry. He wanted to sort of maybe, you know, grab a coffee or something. And I couldn't do it then. And I meant to do it some other time when I saw him, but it just never happened. So, you know, even nasty people that you sort of feel some empathy for them in old age. But Owen Gleiberman said it best in Variety. I hadn't thought about this, but he said John Simon was kind of truly the real life embodiment of the critic, the acidic, hateful critic who hates themselves more than anyone else. Not that I'm saying that about Simon, but they take it out on actors and everybody else. And you saw that critic all the time, from Addison DeWitt in All About Eve to the critic in Ratatouille or the critic in Birdman. That sort of Hollywood idea of the film critic or the critic in general, that was John Simon to a T. And he truly loved that. He loved that role.
Well, you know, I did watch just randomly over the weekend. My kids wanted to see Beetlejuice. And so they watched Beetlejuice. And of course, in Dale. That movie, that's right, the song Dale. The big Calypso song. And it turns out Lord Burgess died at 95. I didn't know he was still alive.
Yeah, Irving Burgee is his name. He was one of the big talents in the Calypso craze and the touring career of Harry Belafonte. Irving Burgee was a songwriter and a performer under the name of Lord Burgess, and he died at 95. It wasn't just a flash in the pan. He had a long career. He did a lot of songs, but he wrote or co-wrote 8 of the 11 songs on Harry Belafonte's landmark album Calypso, which came out in 1956. That had standards like Jamaica Farewell, I Do Adore Her, and he co-wrote new lyrics for the old Jamaican folk tune, Deo, the Banana Boat song. That album reportedly was the first album by a solo artist to sell more than 1 million copies. I'm assuming that means albums like Oklahoma and the cast album to My Fair Lady probably sold more than 1 million copies. They just weren't albums by a single artist. So he had a great career, and unlike most Calypso stars, he was not born in the Caribbean. He was born in Brooklyn in 1924. And in fact, he worked as a camp counselor one summer after military service. He worked at Camp Minisink. And one of his fellow employees was Harry Belafonte. And they bonded and became friends. And they did a performance of the folk tune John Henry that wowed everybody. And, you know, history was made after that. And of course, Deo is heard everywhere from the Yankee Stadium to Broadway, where Beetlejuice is playing on Broadway right now. And the big climax is, of course, Deo. And it even ties into my own personal family.
How so?
My dad and my uncle launched a bar in South Florida, a single bar, and they ended up doing with a third guy who came in, and it was quite successful, did well, and this guy wanted to franchise it. Franchise a bar, which is an asinine, ridiculous, stupid idea. Who the hell franchises a bar? Like a restaurant chain or company. That was sort of new in the 70s, and that was happening. That made sense. But a bar? Who's going to want to go to the same? You're not in the... It's just... What? And that guy wanted...
Don't tell that to Jimmy Buffett. He's like, don't stop. Margaritavilles are everywhere.
Well, this was 40 years ago. And so they thought it was a dumb idea. He wanted to do it. He had more money. And so he bought them out and took the bar that my dad and my uncle had named Banana Boat and franchised it. And while it's a junky chain now, Banana Boat was a big success. You can still find Banana Boat sunscreen in your local drugstore. Drives me nuts every time I see it, because I think of that empire just out of my grasp. If they, the Banana Boat franchise. Oh, well, every time you see Banana Boat or wear a Banana Boat t-shirt or wear Banana Boat sunscreen, think of me.
Well, okay. What about every time you see Faye Dunaway? Will you think of Terry O'Neill?
Do you think of that shot? That's a classic shot.
Yes, absolutely.
The morning after the Oscars, she is poolside, and Terry O'Neill is with her. He was with her all night long and took sort of the T typical shots you would get of a star hoping to win an Oscar and then winning it in press conference and parties. But the photo that really captured the moment was the morning after, where she's poolside, surrounded by a scattering of newspapers and looking exhausted and overwhelmed. It's a great shot of Faye Dunaway. It was one of many great shots that photographer Terry O'Neill took over the years. He died at 81. He took such a good shot of her. He loved shooting her so much, he married her. They got married, but he started off as a teenager working for Fleet Street, the tabloids in London, and he went on from there, and he photographed everyone. I'm going to mention a lot of rock stars because he did them so well. The Beatles, the Stones, David Bowie, Frank Sinatra. But he shot literally everyone and took literally millions of photographs. My first job, again, it all comes back to me. My first job in New York was an internship, unpaid, at Premiere Magazine, the movie magazine, and my job was in the photo department, which I had no interest or ability to do, but they would bring in a bunch of archival photos for a certain story, and they'd come from all these different archive agencies, and I would have to break down the photos to put them all together into one thing for the story, and then break them back again to put them in each photo agency's account so we could send them back properly. And if you lost one photo, that could be thousands of dollars that they would charge you. So it was a responsible job, even if it was pretty meaningless. But I saw the name Terry O'Neill approximately 10,000 times.
Yeah, well, he shot everybody, and mostly in black and white, I might add.
Yes, he did. So a really iconic, terrific photographer who lived the life just in the era when it was best. He had great access, and people weren't shooting everybody and paying attention to them the way he was. So he got there at just the right time. And certainly Robert F.X. Silverman was in the radio and TV and concert business at the right time, because he had a gift for sniffing out opportunity. He died at 71, and you added him into our obituary section. I had not noticed it. Why did you put him in there?
Well, you might recall back in episode 269 or 270. I don't know. I'll place a link to it.
Oh, I remember that episode fondly.
Yes, we talked about SFX Entertainment going bust. Well, that was owned by Robert F.X. Silverman. Okay,
at one
now
point.
He was at one point he was a bit of a mogul. Okay, he built up a whole radio and TV station empire in the 70s, starting in 1973, and then sold it off for $1 billion.
Then he did it again, thanks to Bill Clinton and deregulation. Hello, Trump administration and the Paramount Decree. He built up SFX Broadcasting, gobbling up 70 more radio stations and selling that for $2.1 billion.
That's right. He would like do these roll-ups.
Then he did it again.
By the way, that's right. So he said, well, what's the next thing that needs consolidating? What about the concert industry? So he went and created SFX Entertainment in the late 90s. He gobbled up all these regional promoters, you know, somebody in Austin, somebody in Colorado, somebody.
Yeah, you had cool local people who were sort of their big wigs in their little town. You came to that town, you knew you were dealing with Joey and his venue, you know?
Right. And so he kind of tied them all up, bought them, and bought the venues, or at least the rights to the venues. And then, along came Clear Channel, and they said, well, we'll buy you for $4 billion.
That's it.
They then kind of turned it around and sold it off as Live Nation, which then merged with Ticketmaster. And it was because of that kind of roll-up that a lot of people kind of credit him with these exorbitant ticket fees and exorbitant ticket prices, the actual cost of a ticket, not just the fees.
Blame the artist, I say. But he's certainly responsible too. But his first big pile of stuff was $1 billion. Then he did it again with TV, with radio stations for $2 billion. Then he gobbled up concert venues and promoters and all that stuff, $4 billion. I see a pattern. He was good at making money.
Corporate sponsors for, like, he would basically say, look, Levi's, if you kind of sponsor this tour, it won't just be at Madison Square Garden where you get to advertise. It'll be
all over the country,
Miami and Chicago. Yeah, it'll be everywhere because I own all that. I own it all. But then he sold that off. Then he tried to do the same thing with the electronic dance market and all these music festivals, and they failed miserably in 2012.
He was too old.
2015 is when his SFX Entertainment kind of started to go downhill, and it filed for bankruptcy in 2016.
So you may curse him for your high ticket fees and high ticket prices, but he certainly made a lot of money and impacted all those areas massively.
Correct.
All right. Well, and now theater director Marion McClinton died at 65. He was a really important director. He helped define August Wilson's plays for the world, along with Lloyd Richards of Yale. And August Wilson, for me, is the greatest American playwright of all time. Not the greatest current or recent or person of color. No, period. The greatest playwright.
Neil Simon.
No, not even close. No, I mean the top tier would be Arthur Miller, Edward Albee, Eugene O'Neill, and Tennessee Williams.
What about Will Shakespeare?
American.
I know.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. So he is a major American playwright, to me, the greatest of all time. And so Marion McClinton having a huge impact on his career really matters. He was a Tony nominee for directing King Hedley II on Broadway. He also directed Ma Rainey's Black Bottom on Broadway. And off Broadway, here's where it comes back to me again, he did an acclaimed revival of August Wilson's Jitney that really just took him to another level in a way, in terms of people recognizing the body of work that he'd done, this massive American century cycle that he was doing, one play for every decade. At Second Stage, they did Jitney, and that ran for ages. And over at the Signature Theater Company, they did three plays, all of them tremendously well done. And they were the three plays that were not The Piano Lesson and Fences, but three plays like King Hilly II and Two Trains Running and Seven Guitars that weren't being talked about as much, but they were done so well, everybody just suddenly, you know, realized, oh my God, you know, August Wilson is a talent in our lifetime. And he pushed Wilson to reevaluate Jitney, and they did some serious, I'm sure they were subtle, but serious rewrites and refocusing of that play that helped make it, you know, better. He was based in Minneapolis, St. Paul, though he did return to Broadway and off-Broadway a number of times, just with August Wilson. He worked with a troupe that gave August Wilson his first professional production. That's how important he was to August Wilson's career. He said, quote, "London and New York have the glamour and money, but when you are working on Broadway, you are as much a director as a stage manager, not stage manager, but as a manager, solving people's problems. Here, I get to concentrate on the art without distractions. Of course, I would be lying if I said I ain't missing the pay." But what a great career. And for his key role in August Wilson, I will be always grateful to him. And that production of Jitney was just tremendous. Oh, my God, it was great.
Well, presently, we're missing the pay for this episode.
Because it's free.
Episodes. Because it's free. That's right. But you can subscribe to the show. That's how you can pay us. Subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in any of the podcast aggregators, iTunes, Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher. And I'm pretty sure, well, no, I don't think we're on Spotify yet. I did not get the email, but soon we'll be on Spotify. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com, as well as all those ways to subscribe to us. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, and on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They have their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online, and every week he's got a new and exciting website for us. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it could be, it's still snowing, but I'm going to go with bananaboat.com just to break my own heart, because of course it's taken by Banana Boat. And it also ties into Dale. So there you go.
Okay, well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.